that's in the first part of the introduction. The group of cultural transformations. For a cultural theory in the dimension, we proved that it was O2D. And so remember I mentioned something in the first lecture, and one reason that cultural theories have become interesting and important is that they give us a particular non-perturbative formulation of quantum gravity in a particular geometry. And the simplest way what you just came up with is kind of the sanity check that idiots use in exchange is that this guy can also interpret it as a symmetry of a curved manifold. It's called the dimension, D plus one dimensional anti the Sitter space. By the way, it is the maximally symmetric space, so the space that has maximal symmetry in deep level dimension with a negative cosmological constant. And the basic kind of kinematics of these ideas of correspondence tells you that if you have a space, that near the boundary, so think of this space as having a boundary. And near the boundary, the geometry approaches this anti-Sitter space. So this means, I have more time, I'll explain more carefully what this means, but this means that you have a geometry that is asymptotic to anti-Sitter space. Inside, you can do whatever well things can that are allowed by quantum gravity. That approaches ideas asymptotic. And the statement is that the Hilbert space of quantum gravity in with this asymptotic geometry fits into representations of the asymmetric group of ADN, which precisely for Tokuma D, which also happens to be, so you have here ADNs, a little bit of asymptotic ADN plus one, and the boundary has PSD, which also is the way in which operator or states, we will see, of a conformal theory also fit into representations of over 2 comma D. And sometimes you have a one-to-one correspondence between the Hilbert space of the conformal theory and the Hilbert space in syntactic ideas. And just as a cartoon, just to motivate, I think you may have an ADC report later in the year. But typically what happens is that imagine you are near the boundary and you insert one of these operators we were discussing. That we were interested in computing the correlation function. So this is the boundary theory, this is the bulk. So you insert a few operators. And physically what this does is this creates some kind of excitation in the bulk. Imagine like a graviton, the bulk. And then you have a one-to-one correspondence between bulk excitations. Say, a simple example would be just take empty ADS space with a few gravitons floating around. This is described in the boundary CFT by a certain insertion of operator in the boundary that kind of inject some graviton into the bulk. And this is kind of the base of, okay, so you could spend 3 minutes just on this. Just to give you a flavor of where this object also appears in theoretical physics. It appears as the asymmetries of this. But notice that the correspondence between the conformal group in D-dimension and the asymmetric group in different one dimensions. That's the this kind of corresponds between a bulk D plus one dimensional theory and a boundary D dimensional theory. It's called holographic. So here we won't spend a lot of time, but I just wanted to mention this to so that apart from just exhibiting this guy, so that this guy connects with other things. Okay, so that's one thing I want to say. Something else? Yeah. Another thing I wanted to say that is also kind of important, especially when we discuss several new topics, hopefully this week. One of them having to do with conformal anomalies, essentially the failure of conformal field theory to be realized. So there's you think that you classically have a symmetry, but actually quantum mechanically it's broken. We will see that this gives rise to interesting charges that constrain heavily the type of RG flows that can appear between theories. We're going to be discussing these RG flows from a CFT in the ultraviolet and CFT in the infrared. And precisely that the existence of conformal anomalies will give us a handle on what kind of flows are possible between conformal field theories. So for example, just by using that quantity, you may imagine you have several CFTs. You may wonder, is there a way of flowing from a given CFT to a different one? And using this quantity that gives in the context of anomalies will allow you to say that there are certain flows that cannot occur. Okay? So it's a very strong bound of what kind of monsters can appear in the world. Okay. So the thing I want to discuss a little bit is the idea of this is not only pertinent to conformal field theory, but you can imagine the following thing. You can imagine taking a quantum field theory and coupling it to gravity. So far, we're studying field theory in a fixed Minkowski space, and now you can imagine coupling it to gravity. Just like when you have a global symmetry, like a Flavour symmetry, you can couple the theory to Planck elongation. Okay? So you can have a minimal coupling. So you have a global symmetry. Coupled by a current, J mu, that's conserved. You can couple this quantum field theory to fields, so Python fields that will couple to this curve. So, and the minimal coupling that you will find is that you can add to your theory a coupling of the type A mu J mu. Okay? Where A mu is a background field that may not have any dynamics, it's just some background field that you turn on, and that allows you to study in particular in a convenient way what are the correlation functions of these currents by studying the partition function of the theory as a function. This is related to what I said, so the uncomputed object. And this will give you a generating functional. So this will be a function of mu. And this object encodes the correlation functions of the curve. Similarly, you can couple a quantum field theory to curve space, essentially through the stress energy tensor. So you can add a coupling like this of this type. Okay. And I think you all have a feeling of how, if I give you a theory in flat space, I think you would know how to write down, if this theory has a Lagrangian description, you would know how to make it coupled to a Lagrangian metric and make it in a deep invariant way. Okay. So this is not something very mysterious. Okay, so another useful perspective on conformal field theories is to say the following. Is that, or about conformal, let me first about, before we talk about conformal field theories, let me talk about one way of thinking about a conformal transformations in flat space on a fixed pattern. So first, once you introduce a dynamical metric, you can define what's called a wild transformation. But this is a transformation. Okay, I'm going to write the final part. Where you take a metric, and all that it does is rescale the metric by some factor. Notice that this is not a diffeomorphism, just a local rescaling of the metric by an arbitrary, completely arbitrary function sigma of x. Okay. This transformation is has the property also that it preserves the causal structure of your space-time. And that's why, for example, it's very important. It's very, very often used when you have a space-time and you want to understand what the causal structure is. Namely, if you want to know whether two points are causally connected and you don't care about distances, again, because this doesn't preserve distances, right? What you do is you, for example, construct what's called the Penrose diagram of your space-time. And the way you do it is by doing such a wild transformation. Essentially, you adjust, it's an object that is blind to distances, but only cares about the causal structure, which is preserved by this transformation problem. So a wild transformation can also act on the field in space-time. And if you have a field that has wild charge W, it will transform like that, for example. Notice that this transformation maps a metric to a different metric. In particular, if you start with a metric that was flat, this will no longer be flat. Because mapping manifolds that have different geometrical properties, one can be flat, one can be curved.
A wild transformation doesn't do anything to the coordinates, though, right?
Yes, that's okay. It doesn't do anything to the coordinates. So, for example, I mean, to show that it's something that you more or less know, you can write down very easily. Again, I don't like, for this course, Lagrangian is not important, but let me use an example of Lagrangian, of a theory of a free scalar field. So if you do the coefficient, do this. So here's a theory that is invariant under wild transformation. So if you transform the metric in this way and you rescale the field with W equals D minus 2 over 2, this theory is wild invariant. Notice that this theory, if I go to in the flat space limit, you're going to recover the theory of a free massless scalar field. Okay? So what's the point of this regression? The point is that, well, one point, the main point, but one point, and I don't have time to go all of them because I want to move on to some other things. But the main point I want to say is that yesterday we derived the conformal Killing vector equation. And now I want to provide you a different perspective of what the conformal transformation is from this point of view. So one way you can think about a conformal transformation that we were discussing yesterday is the following. What you do is you do a wild transformation. This changes the metric. Okay? But in order to talk about the symmetry, this is not quite a symmetry because you went from one space-time to different space-time. So there's a relation between the two space-times. To make it a symmetry, what now you can ask is there a diffeomorphism that will bring me back to my original space-time? And then you have a transformation, a combination of two transformations that map you one space-time to itself. And that you would call a symmetry. And to see how the Killing equation will come from this point of view, let me just formalize what I just said. Conformal transformation can be thought in the following sense, in the following form. First, we do infinite. I could also do finite, but let's not worry about that. I want to do the Killing equation, not. First, we do an infinitesimal wild transformation, and you ask, can I do a compensating diffeomorphism such that the metric is invariant? Okay. At the level of form, this means that. It means this. So here I did an infinitesimal wild transformation. I tell you an infinitesimal detail. If I can find such transformations, then I map my spacetime to myself. Okay. And now we can just check that this is precisely given the Killing equation, the conformal Killing vector equation. Because all I have to solve is equation to this Gimino. This guy, remember, under the diffeomorphism, this is my okay, if I do a diffeomorphism x plus theta, then this guy is just minus the lead derivative with respect to the vector field on the metric, which remember was minus. Notice now I'm doing an arbitrary space time. So. So. And this is precisely the conformity with vector equation. So this is a different perspective that would be also very useful when we study conformal field theories and we map them between flat space and the cylinder and so on. And there was also something else I wanted to say. Yeah, something else that you can also say is that, for example, you were asking before what manifolds have conformal Killing vectors. Something that you can now try to prove that imagine you know the Killing vectors in a given manifold. Then you know the Killing vectors on any manifold that's conformally related to it, because what it's easy to show in this equation is that this equation is well invariant. So the conformally equation is well invariant. So if I transform the metric in this way and I transform the vector field in some way, charge one, then this equation is well invariant. So this allows you, for example, to construct the conformal Killing vector from the sphere, which would be a complete nightmare. In terms of the conformal Killing vectors, flat spaces, we're doing it as well. Okay.
So, is it clear that a conformal transformation is a Weyl transformation plus it, and then composed of a Biot morphism?
Yes. What is what it is? What it is essentially the.
Yeah, so that's equivalent to the conformal Killing equation, but is that equivalent to a conformal transformation? A general conformal transformation?
Yes.
Or an infinitesimal one?
I don't know. I could write the finite form of this if you want. Yes, I could write. I mean, I can write it. So.
Okay, I can look it up on my own.
I think that. So here I just wrote the infinitesimal version, not to have parts of the limit of the test. Just basically write the following equation. Right, you have a metric, and let me do two consecutive transformations on this metric. Let me do first a Weyl transformation and then a diffeomorphism.
Okay.
Is that equation the same?
Yeah.
And if you put the tildes in the right place.
Yeah, it's just.
Yeah. Given the existence of control.
But it, okay, so more generally, when we study conformal field theories, we will be, remember that I defined that generating functional, the partition function, which was a way of defining a partition function or generating function of all of the correlation functions in the conformal field theory, or AI are greater than DJ or SAR. Now, something that you can do is to upgrade this to an arbitrary metric. Now, the statement that you have a conformal field theory is the statement that you have a degenerating functional is well invariant. So you have a scalar metric and my sources. So delta has some Weyl weight. This will remain invariant if I have a scale my sources J. Okay, yeah. It's J, some of that J. And it's also deep invariant.
The A here is the index on what?
Okay. No, I'm sorry. No. A is just a label that runs over all operators in your theory. So exactly, it's infinite dimension. It's infinite dimension because, as you will see, conformal field theories have an infinite number of operators. Even though we usually only care about the primary, but anyway, you will know what anyway. And for example, the thing that we will study, one thing that you can use this approach to do is to derive, even though we will find a more simple way to do it, but you can derive what the constraint of conformal symmetry puts in the correlation functions of operators just by imposing that, that the functional is invariant under Weyl and this transformation. But more importantly, what we will find is that generically, this functional, so what is the statement that is Weyl invariant? The statement that is Weyl invariant is the statement that, this is the statement that we will care about. So the partition function is the same as this. Where is this relation? I keep changing the input. And then, so if this guy has dimension delta, then this J has to scale as D, sorry, here, as D minus delta. So O of X will go to omega minus delta A. O of X. So now for this to invite, I have to rescale my sources as omega delta A minus B.
J. You should synchronize between the sigma and the omega.
Because omega is the beta.
Yes, okay, so let me put omega square.
Yeah. Okay, but doesn't root g also, I mean, I'm not sure about the counting there because root g is gonna,
right?
Root g is gonna go like omega power.
Yeah, that's why I have here.
Oh, omega power d, okay.
I have delta m minus d because I had to cancel the metric. And the statement of anomalies will mean that this will not be true. And anomalies are something that you don't need to go to curve space to identify them, but they manifest themselves very physically if you couple your conformal field theory to a curve background. And then we will see very explicitly what are the sources of the anomalies and understand them better. That's why I wanted to mention that this idea of coupling the field theory to the background metrics. Okay, so hopefully I'll do the anomaly story either. Well, not today, but maybe tomorrow or Friday. Okay, so that's. So any questions about this? So how now what we've done is understand the kind of the geometric aspects of conformal field theory. Now we want to understand how these aspects are represented on the operator of the theory and on the Hilbert space of the theory. So maybe before we start, let me ask you. So which operators do you think are always present in a conformal field theory? And remember that we're just talking very abstractly, but from the things that you know about field theory and the things we discussed, which operators should always be present in a conformal field theory? Right? Operators.
Operators.
Yeah.
Stress tensor.
Okay, so why?
Why? Because you have
the one operation of a background
matter. Sorry?
Yeah,
okay, that's a fancy way of saying it, but yeah. But just use the fact, by definition, a conformal field is a field that has those symmetries and the dilatations and
yeah,
so on,
right?
So it means that you have to have
transition.
Yes. So it's you have to have the identity operator that has dimensions, and you have to have the stress energy tensor. What is the dimension of the stress energy tensor?
Right.
Okay, so maybe something I should spell, but you're
four
saying the numbers, there's a gap between them. Yeah, so let's go with it. So what are the things that we said are present in a conformal field theory? We had a conserved charges, right?
Yeah.
That were associated to translation, Lorentz deformations, dilatation, and the spectral conformal deformations. Right? Now these are the space time transformations.
Yeah.
Something that you can, that would not, should not come as a surprise, but the currents. So by another term, any continuous symmetry has a conserved charge. And it wouldn't be surprised that the conserved charges associated with space-time transformations are all constructed from the stress energy tensor. So let's see that. Okay, but the first one is so first of all, how do you construct the momentum generator out of the stress tensor?
Contract the transistors.
Okay, so
Here would be like the general
But so you think this can you talk about the dimension of T has to be so that things make sense? Okay, so in field theory, to any global system, you have a conserved term. Okay. So, and for a conserved term, you construct a conserved charge.
So, if you wanted to
construct a conserved charge. How do you construct a conserved charge? Have you seen this in field theory one? Yeah. Okay, so how do you do it? It's an integral over space, right? So of the zero component, right? That is your charge. And notice that this works because the compute now this is zero using the conservation. Okay, so now again, can you tell me what the current associated to this guy is? To this guy is? Okay, particularly just let's say for energy, we just stimulus you, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is energy? Energy is the integral over space. So this has to have mass dimension one. This has so this means okay, so now I know what the dimension of T has to be. In this equation you should be able to read it.
D,
right? D because this has dimension one, this has dimension D.
But we should be careful with the index placement. Because J really wants to have an upper index, and T really wants to have mixed indices, and then it has dimension D. Because if you lower an index, then you have an extra metric factor, and this becomes D minus 2.
No.
Let's be a flat space. We're a flat space. I can phase and lower the indices.
Okay.
Yeah. So this guy has dimension. And okay, so these are two objects that have to be in the in any form of field theory. And the point is that the current associated to each of these guys, remember that we had this scaling vector that depends on parameters. Each of the parameters were associated to each of these transformations. So we had something like A mu plus then amino, so this was translation, plus rotation, then we had dilatation, and then we had special component transformation. And now you can wonder, stress and intertension is a basic concept that tells you how that has to do with the space-time transformation. So you can ask, how do I construct the current associated? So to which such vector field, I have a set of generator. How do I construct the conserved current associated to this transformation? And the way you do it is you essentially contract the stress tensor with the Kelvin vector. And then you can, I'm saying this, essentially, from here you should be able to prove that this is a conserved current. Mm-hmm. Using the fact that the stress tensor is conserved and traceable. Okay, so, but of course, interesting CFDs have many other operators other than this, and that's what we're going to study now. Okay. Any questions about this?
Is it possible to cancel Weyl anomaly with diffeomorphism anomaly for some background matter?
Well, first of all, diffeomorphism anomaly only happens in very special dimensions. Okay, plus two. I think the answer is I don't think you can. I mean, I don't know what this really means. But anyway, diffeomorphism anomaly can only happen in 4K plus two dimensions. Well, as we will show either tomorrow or Friday. While anomalies can happen in even dimensions, not in other dimensions. There are dimensions in which you have one and not the other. No, I don't think so. I mean, they have to do with different issues. One has to do with the non-conservation of the trace of the stress energy tensor. That's a wild anomaly. And the event has to do with the non-conservation of the stress tensor. Okay, so isn't that very important? Is that one invariant is implied? Okay, I was implicitly using it there. One invariant implies that the trace of the stress energy tensor, okay, I don't know if you can see there. So why? So first of all, something that you know, okay, if you don't know, write it, is that if you look at the functional integral, like the log, whatever, and you do a variation with respect, a arithmetic variation, what you find is that the partition function changes this way. Okay? This immediately tells you something very powerful about what are the implications of wall invariant and deep invariant on the stress tension. So if I impose, if the theory is wall invariant, then delta g mu naught is minus 2 sigma g mu naught, right? And sigma is a completely arbitrary function of x, okay? So from here, what you find essentially is that delta z, times sigma. So this implies, what invariant implies in the trace of the stress tensor band. Okay. While a deep invariant implies the stress. Trace of stress tensor vanishes, and deep invariant, okay, would imply that the stress energy tensor is conserved. So let's see it more explicitly. So let's just, all that we need to do is plug in here what happens to delta G mu naught under the diffeomorphism. So under the diffeomorphism, arbitrary diffeomorphism, what will happen is that you get, as we as I read many times before, this is essentially. So this means that, and since, okay, since P mu naught is symmetric, what this means is that you get something like okay. And again, since psi mu is arbitrary, this implies exactly this relation. So going back to the story, the statement about a wild anomaly would be the statement that the right hand side will stop to be zero. And the statement about deep anomalies is that the right hand side will stop to be zero. So they really talk to different physics. So the right hand side, if you have a conformal a wild anomaly, the right hand side will not be cancelled by any monkey business with deep anomalies. Because it doesn't know about the trace. It talks to different operators.
I mean, I was wondering if they can be captured by some parameter which is the same, and both of the statements are not true, but the theory might be confirmed. So both the trace is not zero, and also the stress energy is not conserved, but you might have confirmed in some very special case.
I would have to. My guess is that this sounds nuts, but I would have to think more carefully. Okay. Good. So, now what we want to do. So now that we have completely understood what the conformal series is, now we want to do is represent conformal symmetries on the operator, the ones that here that are creating gravitons. Just like in quantum theory, in quantum theory, we look for, in that context, it's fields. Usually we think of them as elementary fields in the Patin theorem. Here, remember that these always are not elementary fields in the Patin theorem, these are abstract operators. That you need not think of them as being Patin integrated over. You have a Patin integral, this would be some composite field, for example. And we want to know how to represent conformal symmetries on such operators. But before doing that, maybe we should discuss the dialogue problem for algorithm problem. You remember that the conformal group includes the Poincaré group, okay? So here what we're thinking about is we want to give a representation of the Poincaré group on fields. Okay, so how do you do that? You have to assign certain transformation rules that will be compatible with the Poincaré algebra. And the way you do it, I think you know. So imagine you use some field or operator phi of field or x. First of all, okay, so maybe just to have more interaction. So which kind of quantum number do I have to assign to an operator or field in the Poincaré invariant theory to fully specify its transformation?
Spin.
So that the quantum number under rotation, right? Why is that?
Because so it's a little group for
sign. So people know what this word means? A little group. Maybe just say a little in case someone doesn't really know, but essentially what we want to do is define some operation means is that if you know how the field transforms at the origin, and the origin is fixed precisely by the Lorentz rotation test, at the origin, the only thing that leaves the origin fixed is precisely Lorentz transformations. If I tell you how to represent Lorentz transformation on the field at the origin, and since translations obviously move the origin, I only have to focus on origin transformations. Then the action of the rest of the Poincaré group is just fixed. Because if I know how phi A transforms, if I want to construct how phi an arbitrary other point X transforms, all I have to do is conjugate by translation.
Any argument for phi of B, do you mean to put the inverse Poincaré transformation on space-time?
Excuse me?
The arguments for phi B, should that be
the inverse one?
The inverse Poincaré transformation.
Yes.
Okay, because it's G right there.
So there's an inverse. Which is here you're talking about? This one or this one?
So, okay, usually I denote it with, it's not, like, I don't know, lambda plus A or something.
Okay, okay, so yeah. So, okay,
G
so,
is
but, so X tilde is GX.
Okay.
With A mu plus lambda mu. Mu. Okay, well, but one thing that is very important is that. Okay, so there are two pieces to a Lorentz transformation, to a Poincaré transformation. There's a piece that acts on space time. Okay. Right? Yeah, that acts on the rotation of the coordinate. You could call this the orbital part of the transformation. And then there is a part that acts on the Lorentz quantum number. We call this the spin part. And the thing that is very important is that the way G is realized on the spin and the orbital part is in opposite directions. If this was not the case, this would not give you a consistent representation of the Poincaré group. You can try to say that if you put here G and you do two consecutive transformations, it's not the same as doing, imagine you do a transformation with G1 and G2. If you don't have this inverse here, and you try to do first G1, G2, or G1, then G2, you wouldn't get the same thing. So that's the statement that we have to represent Poincaré not in the proper way, and that's how you do it. Okay, so all that we have to assign for Poincaré is the Lorentz quantum numbers, because that's the only generator that fixes the origin, and then I can move away from the origin by a translation. Okay. So in practice, what this means is that is that under the such transformation, so I have a translation A and a rotation lambda, you know? What I have is that phi A of X so this is going to be a matrix,
okay.
Okay, I'm going to do it like this here. Hopefully it's not confusing, but of course, G is made equal depends on the Lorentz part, not on the Poincaré part, on the translation part. And then I'll have phi G. And this guy labels a representation of Lorentz. So for example, for a scalar, yeah, so now you have to supply a representation of the Lorentz group in the appropriate representation. So you have a scalar, the generators are trivial, you have a vector, the Lorentz generators in the vector representation. So these are the Lorentz generators, these are the representation labels. It would be something like this would be for the vector representations. R is a vector. For a scalar, it would be 0, right? And for a spinner, for example, two factors would be the commutator of the diagram is. And again, you can now just convince yourself that if you do two consecutive transformations by G1 and G2, and you have this assignment rule, you have represented the transformation. Okay. Now, it's useful also to look at the infinitesimal transformation. For example, the infinitesimal transformation, and then delta phi of x looks, which is, again, phi to the phi of x minus phi of x. You have a translation part. And then you have what I was calling the spin part. Okay. So this is the part that just comes from here, from the translation. And this is the part of the spin that depends on the church, on depends on the representation under which the flip platform. Okay. Now you can, in order to convince yourself that this is a proper way of implementing, representing Poincaré on the field, you can now look at the commutator of two transformations that are labeled by two different parameters, delta 1, delta 2, b1 and b2, compute the transformation of phi a. And what you find is precisely okay, where B3 is precisely the B bracket of the two vectors. So this tells you that you have represented the Poincaré group properly. Any questions about this? Just to be quick before we get to the formal. Okay, so now we can try to do a similar analysis for conformal, okay, before that, let's go back to this picture. So now we're in Poincaré. Now we could ask, using the same intuition, what labels do I have to assign to my field operator to completely specify the transformation properties of the operator? So can someone tell me?
Because, I mean, aside from the Poincaré transformations, you'd also have scalar transformations, which.
just guessing. I haven't really thought about it completely yet.
Okay, the logic is exactly the same as here. So the way you would do it is that you have translation. So translation allows you to move any point to any other point. So we just have to focus on the origin. Now, if you remember, what are the transformations that leave the origin fixed? So obviously, this guy is the origin fixed. Remember that also dilatation. Okay? So dilatation maps x mu to lambda x mu. So that tells you that in order to specify the action of the field, I have to represent not only Lorentz, but I have to represent the action of B. And actually, there's a subtlety. It turns out that this guy also leaves the origin invariant. That, I think, is pretty obvious if you think in terms of the inversion translation inversion. So naively, you would say that you have to specify three different quantum numbers: the spin quantum number, the dimension or dilatation quantum number, and the Bess quantum number. And the reason that for the basic operators of the theory, we set these quantum numbers to be trivial, I'm just giving you a physical picture of why the basic operators are called primary, that the ones that transform simply also highest weights of the conformal algebra have this quantum number to be zero. And the reason is that remember that one of the things I was explaining yesterday is that that essentially you have B, you have E mu, you have K mu, and what we saw from the condition relation that this guy lowers the eigenvalue of B, while this guy raises the eigenvalue of B. Okay, because remember that D with P mu was plus and D with P mu was minus. So I mean that if you want to construct a representation that has energy bounded from below, so then the guy, which is called the highest weight, has to be manipulated by K. This is exactly the same as when you study angular momentum. You have J3, J plus, and J minus. The primary, which is the state that's annihilated by K mu, is the analog of the highest weight state, JJ, that's annihilated by J plus. And then all other states in the representation are just built by acting with J minus, right, in the J2. Here they will be built by essentially acting with P. Okay? That will increase the energy. So this is just to say that in the conformal world, we have to assign for primary operators, so the analog of this one, two quantum numbers, the Lorentz representation R and the dimension W. And then you can construct any other operator in that representation, in the conformal algebra, just by acting arbitrary number of times with P mu. That's why a representation of the conformal algebra is dimensional, because you can act with P mu an arbitrary number of times. That's completely different than in this case, right? Because usually, this guy, if you act with J minus, you hit minus J, and you're done. Even though there are complete representations of SU2 where you don't have to do that, but you don't want to know about that. Is at least the picture clear that what are the labels? So maybe to make this precise, I think that so the operators. We'll have two labels. I don't know if it's like all the labels always, but for the time being, I'm going to say, okay, like that. And just to convince you on this theory, imagine I have this operator, and now I look at this other operator. So the commutator of, say, okay. Do you remember that one of them raised the energy, the other one put over the energy? Okay, so maybe I don't have to do it. But, I wanted to make more precise, and just using the commutation of D with P and K to show you that if I look at the descendant, so this guy will be a primary, So it's going to be initialized. The prime is an operator that's initialized. On the operators is at the origin. So this is the definition of a primary operator. The descendants are acting, are obtained by acting with a raising operator. And this will be by acting arbitrary number of times. This guy has dimension delta. If you now compute the dimension of this guy, of this operator, of the descendant operator, so you'll find that this guy has dimension delta plus n. So even the dimension of delta of a primary can be a priori arbitrary continuous number, the dimension of the descendants have a fixed gap, which is integer gap. Good. So this tells us how to do, and again, intuitively, now once you know how to represent the field at the origin, all that you have to do is conjugate now this guy by translation, and you will know how the operator transforms anywhere in space. Okay. So let's now write down the answer. So now if I do a couple of transformation from x to x tilde, so I think you know by now what I mean by this. So I'm going to call this g times x, okay? It's going to be a piece for the transformation that knows about the quantum number and the dilatation delta, that's the dimension of the operator. And then there is kind of a more boring, completely identical to this here, part of the transformation that just has to do with Lorentz quantum numbers. Okay. So this is actually exactly the same as for Lorentz with a wrinkle. Okay. Just a mention there. Where R, okay, so first of all, the first thing is that this looks almost identical to Lorentz, except that, if you wish, this guy transforms as a density, okay? So it has an non-trivial Chekhov factor. And this R is the orthogonal matrix, the x-dependent orthogonal matrix that we constructed out of the Jacobian of the transformation, okay? Remember that the conformal transformation was something like this. And we concluded that you can define a matrix, Calligraphic R, you know, it's now x dependent. The omega inverse dx mu dx mu. It has a property that it's an orthogonal transformation. So R transpose eta R. Okay. So notice that all that I'm doing is doing exactly the same thing I was doing for Lorentz. Except, of course, except for Lorentz, the matrix that appears here, erased it, was lambda mu, right? The measure of the Lorentz transformation, which is a constant Lorentz transformation. Here it's a x dependent Lorentz transformation. Okay. So this part is exactly the same as in the Poincaré group, just taking into account that you have to incorporate this well factor. Okay. And then this is a density. One way you can derive this transformation, also, by the way, that's why I also mentioned this while was this story, is that you know from general relativity how tensors transform the diffeomorphisms. I told you how things that transform properly under web transformations, not from the web transformations. So now if you concatenate a web transformation with a diffeomorphism, you'll get exactly this. So that's actually a way of deriving how things should transform. Once you know that how diffeomorphisms act on tensors and how well transformations act on operators. If you do that exercise, maybe with the test, you will recover exactly the same thing. Okay.
One other way to think of this is that although scalars are diffeomorphisms, diffeomorphisms, you can have densities that are conformally there. In all generality, scalars are different variants. So, but if you have wireland diff, then you can have even densities, right?
Yeah.
So that's more.
Yeah. So the point was that this factor comes completely from the wire part of the transformation,
mm-hmm.
but it has to do with that omega, and that omega. Okay, it's a big careful here. Omega. Once you identify the wild transformation with a compensating diffeomorphism, what you find is that this is a determinant of the Jacobian.
Mm-hmm.
One over this. So the density part of the transformation comes from the wild part of the transformation. The diffeomorphism is just boring, they just do this. Now, for example, let me just again look at the infinitesimal form of the transformation. So now, if I do infinitesimal transformation, then equals pi, keep calling it 1, 5, 6, and S. Hopefully, you know what I mean. So again, there is a purely geometric part. Let me write and then I explain the physics of this. Okay. So this is arbitrary conformal Killing vector. What you get is this transport part, the transformation operator under translation, and the generated by the conformal Killing vector. You get a special dependent Lorentz transformation, the spin part, and then you get this other, in general, x dependent dilatation. Okay? And these quantities, sigma x, just so even though the local Lorentz, even though the special conformal transformation was something disgusting, at the level of the field, all that it really does is act as a local Lorentz rotation and a local dilatation. Notice that B, which was the guy that generated the special conformal transformation, the way it acts on the field is just like a rotation. Or a dilatation, this parameter. So nothing good about it. And again, you can to make sure that this is the right transformation. If you were not convinced, you can compute. To consider transformations and convince yourself that this is a proper representation of the conformal algebra. Any questions? No? Okay, so now what I want to do, now that we have finally enough nothing that's important to say is that even though primaries transform in this simple way, in a linear way, it means that, notice that the variables that appear here are the same operator back, okay? If you look at the transformations and the conformal transformations, the transformations of a descendant, Can someone tell me what do you expect will be different in this case? First of all, can you tell me what will change in this transformation? Sorry? It's okay, so delta will change because I already told you that delta increased by 1.
Yeah.
What else do you think can happen?
The points, space time points.
Okay, we come in.
No, so this will not really change, right? It will be. Now, this guy, of course, there is a Lorentz quantum numbers. You, of course, you change that representation to be that representation, but this doesn't change. This, of course, also doesn't change. But what can happen is that for a descendant, the conformal transformation of a descendant can mix with the highest weight state. So it means that it will have a linear part, will be proportional to B mu or A. But then there can be a Fischer transformation, in fact, that couples to the highest weight vector. So it will be something like B mu. So that's why descendants, even though we know completely the transformation properties and the conformal transformation, they're not as simple because they get mixed with operators that are one dimension lower than that. This is exactly okay. So this sounds mysterious, this is exactly the same as in SU2. You apply an SU2 transformation to a state that's not in the highest weight, it will talk to the guys upstairs and downstairs. But the key point in conformal filter is that even though you have these guys that don't transform as neatly, the properties of, once you know how correlation functions of the primaries, what the correlation functions of the primaries are, you, just using algebra, determine the correlators of the descendants. So descendants are very important in constructing the Tudor space of the theory, but their dynamic is completely fixed by conformal invariance. That's why we focus mainly on the primary, because the descendants, they're just fat that you have to carry around, but important fat. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that. And you can, of course, derive the transformation rules just knowing using the algebra. And that's the point. That everything is determined from the algebra. Okay, so now what we want to do is, so the reason I said this is that now what we want to do is, as I said, you have two types of operators. You have primary and descendant. As I said here in words, these guys are completely determined in terms of physics. So now what I want to do is study the constraints that conformal invariant imposes on the correlation function of primary. So let me go through that a little bit. We have too much detail because and it's probably not good that I do arithmetic in front of you, but I just want to explain what the ideas of how you derive the constraints are, and you do it yourself. Okay, so what is the basic constraint that of conformal invariants and correlators? So again, you have a point x, you go to x tilde, you have an operator O, goes to an operator O tilde, okay? The statement that you have conformal invariants is this. Is that if you take the transformed operator at the transformed point, the correlation function of this operator has to be the same as the statement of dissociativity, the statement that it should be the same as the correlator of the operator O pushed to that point x tilde, the same point x tilde. So this is the consequence of conformal invariance. Is this clear, the statement? You can derive this from many, many different ways, but I think the statement is clear, that in order to compare two things, you have to compare two things at the same point. So all you do is you look at the transform field at the point and compare it with the original field and push to that point. And this is exactly what the equation summarizes. So if you want to be pedantic, let me write this formula once. What this means is that these are the equations that you have to solve. disjunct because of this. Here I just plugged in the transformation this did. That's all it. So now you can go ahead and try to study the consequences of conformal invariant, starting from the simplest possible correlator, which would be the one-time function. And see what we get. We'll see some miracle. So let's look at the one-point function, one operator, OX. And I guess for most of the analysis here, I'll focus on scalars, scalar operators, so I don't have to worry too much about this matrix part, which is annoying. Anyway, Lorentz invariants will kill the one-point function of a Lorentz invariant operator. So now we can start imposing this constraint for each of the different transformations in the conformal group. So of course, translational invariance implies that this guy has to be a constant. I think that's nothing. No one would be unhappy to say that. Another just way to get an intuition about this is that you can take this transformation and do one infinitesimal transformation, and you will get, for example, if you look at translation, what you should get is something like essentially the statement that A mu, D mu, acting on this guy is 0. Is that clear how you would get that from that? Just expand those as infinitesimally, you will get this. Now, scale invariants. Now let's impose a scale invariant, where x tilde is lambda x. This will imply that lambda minus delta c equals c. Okay. If I impose the dilatation invariant on this, given that already the one-point function is fixed by dilatation invariant to be c. So this implies, already given a fairly interesting result, that the one-point function of a primary operator, it's a constant only if delta equals 0, which is the identity operator, and it's 0 otherwise. So there are no interesting one-point functions in conformal field theory in the full spacetime. If you start doing interesting things like putting the system on a boundary, and maybe a little bit of an exercise, I repeat this exercise, if instead of studying the constraint on RB, you put on your spacetime a boundary at xd equals 0, say, and study what are the constraints of conformal invariants in studying the one-point function of x in this upper half plane. What you should see is that now conformal invariants allow this correlator to be non-zero. And the reason will be is that putting a boundary does what?
Breaks
some conformal transformation,
yeah.
And then it relaxes the constraint, and you can find something. Okay. Now let's do the two-point function. So for the two-point function, I think you will not be surprised that you will tell me what the constraint of Lorentz and scale. So, translational invariant imposes on the two-point function. Well, let's now go to the two-point function. So, OX or Y. So, what would translational and Lorentz invariant imply? Yeah, it's a function of X and Y, the distance. Okay. But now let's look at the scale invariant. So here, how much is this one? Let me just put this one example more or less thoroughly, and then the other one I need to work out. I mean, it's completely now clear what you're supposed to do. Again, this is only for scalar. So now I use the transformation rule under a dilatation. Under a dilatation, this guy goes into lambda minus delta 1, lambda minus delta 2, O y, but we call OX or Y. So it means that, sorry, lambda. Sorry, you start scaling, there's a few different ways. So this means that this is the same as F of lambda X minus Y. So we have the constraint that lambda minus delta 1 plus delta 2 f of x minus y equals f of lambda x minus y. Okay. What does it imply? Tells us that f minus y has to be 1 minus x minus y to delta 1 plus delta 2. And this is what we expected. There is no length scale in the problem. So the only thing that you can have the correlators have is have some power law behavior. Okay.
Do you make constant in the numerator?
Of course, yeah. But we're not done. We have imposed scale transformation. We have not imposed number, we should impose a special conformal. So this is a bit unpleasant, even though completely conceptually clear. It turns out that for this particular correlator, even though I keep warning you that imposing inversion is too strong in general for a conformal field theory, if the theory is parity odd, you can verify that the constraint that conformal invariance imposes are the same as the constraint that inversion imposes, and it's easier to check inversion, of course. And if you work it out, what you will find is a nice little exercise. What this will tell you is that
why do you need to worry? Because inversion is Z2, so I have to do it twice if I have to represent a special conformal transformation. So even if the theory were very odd, then it should still be special.
No, but here I'm only going to, the way I'm going to do that, I'm going to use inversion 1. Of course, if you use it twice, you have not get in.
Yeah.
Okay, so here the cheat, if you will, is that I'm going to use inversion 1 and declare victory. But then, the point is that if you do it special conformal 1, you get the same. You get no further than the constraint. But of course, if you do the three of them, of course, you. But that's a mess. Well, no, I mean, you see, it's trivial logic, but it's, I don't want to do the part of it. So essentially, if you now impose a special conformal, what you will find is that the following interesting result, that this guy will be 0 if delta 1 is different than delta 2. So the two-point function of operators of different dimension vanish, and you will get 1 over x1 minus x2 to the 2 delta. Again, it can be, of course, a constant here. If delta 1 equals delta 2. So this means, so one thing that we learned here is that the dimensions of operators can be read off elementarily from the two-point function of operators in the CFT. And it is the subject of the set of critical phenomena to compute this number, because this tells you how thermodynamic properties scale as you approach the critical point. Okay.
So can you use inversion instead of special conformal for any correlator?
No, that's the point. No.
Just for two-point.
Yeah, so usually for parity even theories, it doesn't matter because parity even theories will include inversion. Just if you have a field that's parity. I can give an example in three dimensions, for example, of a particular tensor structure that can appear in a 3-point function that you would miss if you imposed inversion. But that's allowed if you only impose a special conformal. And that structure involves a tensor, the epsilon tensor, which is parity of. That's important. To just, it's important to keep it in your mind. Okay. Okay, so I think the pattern is clear. I will do the 3-point function, but now I'm not really going to do it. I'm just going to So, okay, so maybe now that you have an intuition, can you tell me what you could write down based on Lorentz invariants, translational invariants, and dilatation? Let me just write the final answer. So here again, you have to, of course, the translation and Lorentz information just tell you that you only have dependence on the distances between the Laffey distances here. Right? Then scale invariance tells you that the overall dimension of this guy has to be the sum of the dimension. So that amount of delta 2 plus delta 3. Just like here, that one plus delta 2 is the sum of the dimension. And the special conformal actually determines completely the power structure. So here, let me put this, just to use the notation, I use yesterday of this tensor, CABC. So the most general thing you can have is CABC times X12. So X12 means that the Lorentz invariant is between 1 and 2 of delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3, X13. Delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2, and x 2, 3, delta 2 plus delta 3 minus delta 2.
Okay. I have a question. Is this for arbitrary operators or just scalar operators?
Right now it's only scalar operators.
Oh.
You will be very happy that I don't really do tensors with this. Actually, I may do one just to torture you a bit, but no. So this notice that the position dependence of the correlator is absolutely fixed. This is kind of amazing. Just like a different point was completely fixed. There is no other possible structure allowed. Notice that it is very different than if you had a scale invariant theory. In the scale invariant theory, the position dependence of the correlator is not fixed at all. You could have ratios of distances. That's a scale invariant quantity. But a special conformal doesn't allow that. They only allow this very particular combination. So that says that there are two invariant tensors in this game. Let's call it CABC for the T-prime function. Here, I could have called this GAB. And as I said yesterday, and you will see in detail next week, the correlation function of an arbitrary endpoint function can be constructed just using three basic facts: that you know the spectrum, or generally the two-point function, that you know the three-point function, and that you know how to capture the contribution of descendants, which are completely fixed by conformal symmetry. Okay. So from this, you can, from this data, you can construct any endpoint function. So now you can imagine what happens if I do a four-point function. Is it going to be fixed? And the answer is no. So of course the form of the correlator is constrained. But now what you have, now let's be in a, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that it's too much. What I want to say is that here you can construct out of these 4 points. You can construct two conformal invariant cross ratios. Okay. So you can convince yourself, this again is elementary arithmetic, that if I take first segment. Now that I have 4 points, I can construct this particular ratio of distances. And the first thing you can prove is that these guys are conformal invariants. Okay. What does this mean? Is that if I look at the constraints of conformal invariants input in the 4-point function, it will not constrain in any way the dependence of an arbitrary function of these cross ratios will satisfy all the conformal word identities. Another way of saying this constraint is called word identities. So now all of a sudden, the four-point function is not completely fixed by conformal invariants. There is an arbitrary function you have to compute. But again, you will know how to compute it if you knew the two-point function, the three-point function, and the sum of intermediate states that is fixed by conformal symmetry. Another point is that there is an interesting function that you have to go out there and compute.
Is there any good reference to see an example done
of
calculation of four-point functions?
Well, so that this is what you will see next week.
Oh.
So that's the whole point of next week is to use crossing symmetry to telecompute the four-point function. I mean, these functions are complicated because in order, okay, so roughly speaking, the way you do this, you have four-point functions and think it this way. It has to do with the operator product expansion. So what you do is you do the operator product expansion of two operators, and you expand them in the basis of operators. Yeah. Another way, more physical way of saying it is that what you do is you insert a complete set of states. Yeah. Okay. So you have a sum over all possible states in the Hilbert space. This is the same as summing over all possible operators here. The energy of the state will be given by the dimension. And then what you have is the product of two three-point functions that gives the three-point function of O1, O2, and the operator that appears here in the OPE. Likewise here. And now you have to sum over all intermediate states. This means summing over the primaries and all the tower of descendants that come with it. And one of the complications in this business is that the tower of descendants, even though it's completely fixed by symmetry, their contribution to the correlation functions are given by non-trivial special functions that capture the, essentially. Anyway, the thing you have to learn how to compute in some sense is, if you know the three-point function of three primaries, how do you compute the three-point function of two primaries and one descendant? Well, this can be a bit nasty, you have to take lots of derivatives.
And when you insert the complete set of operators, are they normalized by some coefficients or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, this, yeah, so.
Oh.
If you will. So this index was raised and lowered with the metric. So if you do that two, if you normalize your two and three-point functions, everything is fixed.
Will this sum converge?
Sorry?
Will this sum?
Yeah. Converge? So this is a very good question. The reason it converges in conformal field theory is that it doesn't converge generically in OPE of quantum field, or standard quantum field theory is the following fact that I have not fully explained. It was called the operator state correspondence, which means that it's a one-to-one map between operators, primaries and only descendants, and the Hilbert space of the theory. And roughly speaking, the way that you can think of the convergence is the following, is that in quantum mechanics, and we're used to decomposing the identity as an infinite sum over intermediate states, so it's a perfectly convergent thing to do. And that's what we're doing here, essentially. So the thing that makes the OPE convergent in conformal field theory is precisely the statement that the operator state correspondence. This is just a standard sum over intermediate state that is perfectly convergent. Okay, I want to say something about tensors, but maybe this is too much. Okay, I'll leave it to an exercise. So, imagine I want to compute the two-point function of currents. So two currents. There are two covariant tensors. Again, just using show. Okay, what I want to do is to show using conformal invariant, the concept of conformal invariant, that this guy takes the following form. There's a tensor I mu x minus y divided by x minus y to the delta. Right. Where I is a very important tensor that I can write explicitly. So I mu nu of x is delta mu nu minus 2 x mu, x squared. This essentially is the tensor, which is the Jacobian of an inversion. That's why you do what I, right? And has a remarkable property that it behaves as a connection. It transforms as a connection. And that's what you need to use to prove this. So the basic thing that if you use this following property, which is straightforward to check. So x tilde is the action of inversion of an x. It has the following property. It transforms an x in the following sense. So if I make an inversion on this tensor, you get the tensor back with, yeah, so I don't know if you're familiar with like connections, but essentially you get a transformation by the same matrix at the point x and the point y. So this allows you to transport, if you wish, pairs of points under inversion. And if you follow the same logic, now just apply to vectors, you should be able to show that this is it's completely straightforward, but I don't want to do it. You can also do it for the one that's very important, of course, is the stress tensor. But again, the point here is that the right-hand side of the stress tensor will be completely fixed in terms by easily concatenating these basic objects. Okay? So I is the right answer when you have one component. If you have more, you just have to put them together. So let me just write the answer. So here will be this number Cd, which will have very important physical meaning and has to do, again, precisely with anomalies. And then the position dependence is just completely fixed by conformally bound. Okay, this is x. Okay, let me put it at 0. Minus. So on and so forth. And you can follow the same logic by putting together in a pretty obvious way these I's to construct what the correlator would be for higher rank tensors. And here, as I said, it is a quantum number that we'll have to look for anomalies that we'll discuss hopefully tomorrow. Or later. There are more things I could say, but I shouldn't say that. You could imagine more complicated things when you have 3-point functions with one vector component, then you have to define another basic object, which is, so here we had I. There's a kind of a natural invariant tensor that you can construct around 3 points that will appear when you have correlation, 3-point functions that depend on 3 points and one has one vector in there. Okay. This guy, I will just write it down. So you have 3 points, x, y, and z. The second invariant tensor appears all the time when you constrain the correlators of 3 points that have a vector index, which is of this type. And now, essentially, the reason I want to write it is essentially now for all tensors, by suitably for any n-point function, by suitably combining I And this guy, you can constrain the correlator. Up to, of course, cross ratios that don't have a return. Okay, so we're going to have time on this.